Let us unite in prayer. Almighty and most merciful Father, who art creatively and redemptively at work in the world at this moment, we thank thee for the gospel which has brought life and immortality to light. We rejoice that thou hast called us to thy service, and we pray that thou wilt make us worthy of our calling. Illumine our minds with the light of truth. Strengthen and instruct our wills with thine eternal purpose. And enable us daily to grow in the grace as well as in the knowledge of Jesus Christ, our Lord. We commit to thy care those for whom we have promised to pray this day, in the assurance that thou art able to do more for them than we ask or think. Guide and sustain thy servant as he shares the treasures of his mind with us, and make us eager to hear and swift to obey thy word. In the Spirit of Jesus Christ, amen. It is my privilege to welcome you to these lectures and to present the lecturer. Dr. John Bright of Richmond, Virginia, earned the BA degree at the Presbyterian College at Clinton, South Carolina. He earned the BD degree and the THM degree at the Union Theological Seminary in Virginia. And he earned, you notice I'm using the word earn, he earned the PhD degree at Johns Hopkins University. He is a learned man and a devout man. He is a distinguished teacher and a productive scholar in a deep sense. He is a man of God who knows how, with clarity and precision, to interpret the Word of God, as it is set forth in the Bible and in the momentous events of our time. We are glad and grateful in the opportunity to welcome and to present to you Dr. John Bright.
President Binkley, colleagues and friends, let me for my part say what an honor I count it to have the privilege of these 2 days with you on your campus. We are really close neighbors, and yet it is a pity how little we see of one another. And I am delighted that I have this opportunity to make up this grievous shortcoming. It is a pleasure to be with you. Now, the subject of these two lectures is actually covenant and promise in pre-exilic Israel. Now, that's a broad subject. It's one that involves the whole question of the origin and development of eschatology in the Old Testament, and in particular the forms that it took in the preaching of the pre-exilic prophets. It's a big subject. You may suspect that I have chosen it in the hope that it will excuse the superficialities of which I shall surely be guilty as we proceed. Although it may seem illogical to do so, we shall take our start with the book of Jeremiah, for the subject was suggested to me by a problem that arises there. It was a problem that plagued Jeremiah all of his life, a problem that arose from the fact that his view of his country's future and that of his contemporaries was simply not the same, and from his inability to convince anyone that his view was the correct one. Now, Jeremiah lived, of course, in the last days of the kingdom of Judah, and all his life the burning question before his nation was that of survival. From the days of Josiah's reform through the dark days of the Babylonian advance down to the crash in 587, the question was always, what course ought this nation to take if it is to survive, to secure its future? What must it do to survive? Would it survive? Now, Jeremiah clearly became convinced it would not survive. And as the years wore on, he said this ever more plainly, till in the end his message became the flat announcement that the Babylonians would destroy this nation, bring the Davidic dynasty to an end, and in doing so were God's own agents of judgment upon it for its sins. But what is equally clear is that this was not the majority opinion. It was, in fact, dangerous to express this opinion, and on more than one occasion, Jeremiah almost lost his life for expressing it. Jeremiah's opponents, then, and the prophet, had radically different views of the nation's future, and they found Jeremiah's view unacceptable, false, dangerous, blasphemous. Now, so explosive attention can't be explained merely as a difference of opinion regarding the nation's policy. Oh, yes, it was that, and Jeremiah's opponents, who were ardent patriots, clearly regarded him as a defeatist and a traitor. But this wasn't a mere clash between patriotic men who had calculated the odds and believed their country could win through, and a pessimist who had likewise weighed the odds and believed it didn't have a chance. And least of all was it a collision between a man of sincere theological convictions, Jeremiah, and men, his opponents, who didn't have any convictions. Whatever we may think of those prophets who contradicted Jeremiah, there's not the slightest reason for saying that they were insincere. Jeremiah made no such accusation. Indeed, he indicated it more than once that he wished he could believe their optimistic predictions. You see, the truth is, Jeremiah and his opponents held equally strong theological convictions. Jeremiah was convinced on theological grounds that the nation was under judgment and would be destroyed. His opponents were convinced, also on theological grounds, that such a thing could not happen. God would not allow it. He will never allow this nation to be destroyed. He will intervene in the nick of time with a miracle and will save it. The fact that they drove their country to suicide does not alter the sincerity of their convictions. This was a collision precisely in the realm of theology, a clash between two understandings of the nation's relationship to its God and its future under God, a clash regarding the nature of God's promises to and his purposes for this country. It was a clash, if you please, in the realm of eschatology. How could such a thing be? Now, to answer that question, we have to go a long way back and cover things that we cannot cover here. We have to ask after the nature and origins of eschatological expectations in Israel. But first, we had better clear with a definition, in what sense are we using the word eschatology? It has been used in various ways, and this has created a great deal of confusion. Thus, one scholar will speak of the eschatology of the 8th century prophets, or may even talk of a pre-prophetic eschatology, while another scholar, equally competent, will declare that Israel had no eschatology till near the end of the post-exilic era. Then you read more closely and you see they're both talking about the same thing but operating with a different set of definitions. Thus, for example, the great Norwegian scholar Sigmund Mowinckel defines eschatology as a developed doctrine or complex of ideas about the last things, which involves a dualistic conception of the course of history, the conflict of divine and demonic powers, which will end in the catastrophic destruction of this present world and the ushering in of a new and better age by the power of God. And with that definition, he will not speak of eschatology till the end of the Old Testament period. Now, if that definition is correct, he is, of course, right. Early Israel had no doctrine of the end of the world, of the last judgment, of resurrection, or eternal life. But one wonders if this definition is not too narrow to do justice to what we have in the Old Testament. Is it not defining eschatology our way and then complaining that the Old Testament has very little as we would understand the term? In this lecture, we shall use the word more broadly, for from a very early period, as Mowinckel knows, Israel's faith had an orientation toward the future that was characteristic and unique. Perhaps in the popular mind, this was no more than the expectation of good things to come, blessing, prosperity, and victory for the nation. But in the pre-exilic prophets, this became expectation of a definitive divine intervention through which God would first judge and then redeem his people and bring his purpose in history to a triumphant conclusion. Moreover, the 8th century prophets developed certain patterns to describe this expected intervention, and these became classic, retained their validity through the centuries to come, and were taken up by prophet after prophet in a variety of ways. One thinks of the messianic hope, for instance, which began with Isaiah, of Hosea's expectation for a reestablishment of the covenant bond beyond the wrath of God which was coming upon North Israel. Now, this isn't eschatology in the later Jewish or Christian sense. There is no supra-historical termination, no end of the world. The terminus is on earth within history, but it is a terminus, the consummation of the divine purpose beyond which men need not look and which they in fact did not look. I've often wondered that if we could meet Isaiah in heaven somewhere and ask him, Isaiah, what did you expect to take place after the coming of that ideal Davidic king? He would say, man, what are you talking about? That was it. It was the termination of God's purpose in history. But clearly the 8th century prophets did not originate Israel's future hope. They gave it classical form, but they did not originate it. The people whom they addressed already had a lively hope for the future. To mention but one example, Amos cries out, "Are you that eagerly desire the day of Yahweh, the day of the Lord?" Now that's the first mention of the day of Yahweh in the Bible. But it is clear from the way Amos spoke that the expectation was already well entrenched in the minds of his hearers. They eagerly desired such a day, were eagerly waiting for the day of God's intervention when he would crush Israel's foes and bring victory and blessing to the nation. Now, Amos did not deny the validity of that concept. He stood it on its head. He didn't say, no, no, my people, you're mistaken. There is not going to be a day of Yahweh. He said, yes, indeed, there will be a day of Yahweh, but you don't want to see it. It will not be what you look for. It will be a day of your judgment, not of your triumphant establishment in victory. The day of Yahweh thus is taken in to the prophetic view of the future and reinterpreted. So it is clear that the prophets did not originate Israel's future hope. It was already there. The belief that history moves toward better times, toward promises. And if the prophets radically reinterpreted it, they were still working with concepts and beliefs that were already at home in the minds of their hearers. Now, we cannot pause to discuss the origins of this future hope that is so characteristic of Israel from earliest times. It's a disputed point. My own position would be similar to that of Ashrot and Funrod, who are themselves quite similar at this point. Certainly, we can say, just to pass it over, it was not a borrowing from outside, nor did it arise merely from the frustration of national ambition, though this played a part, nor did it grow simply and only from cultic expectations that had lost their present reality, though this too played a part. It is not to be explained in this way. Rather, its origin must be sought at a deeper level, specifically in Israel's understanding of her God, of history, and of the activity of her God in history, and her relationship to that God. In a word, in the essential nature of the faith that called her into being as a people. Now, a note of promise and orientation toward the future is, in fact, characteristic of Israel's faith as far back as we can go with it. We cannot pause to discuss again the nature of Israel's earliest faith in general, but it was a phenomenon unique in the ancient world, different from the paganisms of the surrounding countries in a thousand ways. It was not keyed to the rhythmic pattern of nature, but to the events of history and the activity of God in history. Israel's relationship to her God was not based in the nature of things in Blut und Boden, blood and soil, but in historical experience. It rested in God's gracious election of her, his covenant with her. Now, this understanding of reality is reflected in the Hexateuch narrative as you read it in the Bible, of course. In fact, one could say it's its overarching theme. Here we read how God called Abraham, promised him land, posterity, and blessing, and how after his descendants had suffered hard bondage in Egypt, he led them forth in the Exodus miracle, gave them his covenant and law at Sinai, led them through the desert to give them the promised land. The whole story of the Exodus, the leading through the desert, and the giving of the land is told and seen as fulfillment of the promises made to the fathers. Now, on the surface, this presents a theologically harmonious picture. Yet even here, one may see, as I think George Mendenhall was the first to point out, hints of two conceptions of Israel's election and her relationship to God, which have in them two possible ways of looking at the future. They are not intrinsically compatible, not at all. One might say that they are complementary and both necessary to the structure of Israel's faith. Yet the possibility of a certain tension exists between them. And both are equally primitive, and both are associated with the word covenant. On the one hand, there is the covenant made with Abraham. We encounter this again and again through the book of Genesis, from the first call of Abraham in chapter 12, on through the remainder of the stories about him and about Isaac and about Jacob. We cannot go into these texts, but the clearest example is in Genesis 15, where the transaction is specifically called a covenant which God has made with Abraham. Here Abraham, you will recall, does not believe in the promise of great seed, for here he is an old man and he has no children. And God takes him out in the night and points him to the skies and asks him if he can number the stars and promises him his descendants will be as numerous as they. Then after a solemn ceremony, we read in verse 18, on that day Yahweh made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants I will give this land, and its dimensions are described. Now, this understanding of the relationship of God to people is quite old. We cannot here debate it. Indeed, if Albrecht Alt is correct, it has its roots in the tribal clan religion of the Northwest Semitic semi-nomads from which Israel's remotest ancestors derived. It is quite different in form, as we shall see, from the covenant at Sinai. For here, you note, the relationship between God and people, the covenant, is based in unconditional promises for the future, in which the believer is, the recipient, is required only to trust. He does not say, Abram, if you'll do this, if you'll do that, I will make you a great nation. I will make you a great nation. I will give you this land. And we may suppose, as people of this old tribal background settled in Palestine, they came to view their land as the promised land, their title to it resting in divine promises, their possession of it for all the future, secured by the unconditional promises of God. But we also encounter another pattern of covenant, that of Sinai. This covenant was constitutive of Israel. It called her into being early and late. Israel remembered the Exodus event as the supreme exhibition of the divine grace. And early and late, she remembered how God led her to Sinai, gave her his covenant in law, and made her his people, and then through his mighty power led her on to the promised land. Early and late, Israel viewed God's grace in the Exodus as the basis of her bond with him and obligation to him. And early and late, she recited these events to reaffirm this covenant obligation to him. Again, we can't go into the text, but in those old credos in the book of Deuteronomy, which Von Rad has pointed out, say Deuteronomy 26, we have the picture of the old tribesman coming to the shrine with the first fruits of his produce, and he stands and makes confessio fidei. A wandering Aramean was my father. He went down to Egypt, and there the Egyptians pressed him great and sore, but they cried to Yahweh, and he led them from Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm unto this land flowing with milk and honey as it is this day. Now my gifts. The grace of God puts me in obligation. Or you will see it even stronger in that story of the covenant ceremony at the last of Joshua, Joshua 24. How Joshua recites the entire Heilsgeschichte from the patriarchs down to his own day and then says, choose you this day whom you will serve. I'm going to serve Yahweh. And the people say, we will serve Yahweh, and there is covenant. So here you see the covenant rests in the prevenient grace of God and issues in stringent stipulations. The pattern of the covenant is one of the suzerainty treaties of the ancient empires of the world, as Mendenhall was the first to point out, though we cannot go into that here. Thus we see that the Sinai covenant was not a bargain between equals. It was a vassal's acceptance of the gracious overlord's stipulations. It rested in the recognition of God's prevenient grace and the acknowledging of him as the supreme and sovereign overlord, and it issued in no unconditional promises, but in binding obligation under threat of the covenant curses in the event of disobedience. With such a view of her relationship to God, Israel must also see the future as subject to condition. The future is laid under an if. If you will obey my voice, then I will make of you a great nation. Still, the future is left open. If there is the threat of dire penalty in the event of disobedience, there is also the assurance that if the stipulations are met, the overlord's favor will be endlessly continued. Such a theology does not make for complacency, but it doesn't make for despair either. As a matter of fact, we see in the earliest literature of the Old Testament an exuberant confidence to the future. This would be beyond us to go into, but read those ancient poems which are now embedded in the Pentateuch, such as the Balaam poems in Numbers 22 and 23 and 24, or the blessing of Moses in Deuteronomy 33, or the blessing of Jacob in Genesis 49, or the song of Miriam in Exodus 15. And again and again you read the theme, Israel is a people set apart by Yahweh, protected by him, against whom no foe, no curse can avail, defended by the God who brought her from Egypt and gave her this land. Her future is one of unimagined plenty and blessing. You will see this theme again and again in these very, very archaic poems that are now in the Pentateuch. Now, this is not eschatology in any sense of the word. It looks for no terminus in history. Rather, it is an exuberant confidence that the God who has given the land in accordance with his promises will secure his people in possession of it and continue his blessing of them into the indefinite future. That is not eschatology, but it is the seedbed from which eschatology was to grow. But of course, another factor in forming Israel's future hope, as I need hardly tell you, was the great achievement of Royal David. Under David and his son Solomon, of course, Israel reached its golden age of power and glory. Now, of course, we can't stop here to discuss the events of the rise of the monarchy in Israel or of the triumphant career of David and all of his victories, how he brought the Ark of the Covenant to a shrine in Jerusalem and how Solomon built the temple there, nor can we trace the chain of events whereby Israel passed from the old tribal order to a dynastic state. We cannot delay upon any of these things. They evoke tension, as we very well know, from the Bible story. But the truth is that David made upon the minds of his people an unforgettable impression. Not only did he bring Israel to heights of glory undreamed of before and only to be dreamed of after, all the land thought of as promised was now, for the first time and for the last time, Israelite. You can almost see this note played upon in the Bible if one looks back, for example, to the promise to Abraham in Genesis 22, 17 and following, I will indeed bless you, multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven, the sand which is on the seashore. Your descendants shall possess the gates of their enemies, and so on and so on, and then connect that with the dimensions of the land from the border of Egypt all the way to the great river Euphrates. And then if one turns on to the stories of the glories of David and Solomon in First Kings, about the fourth chapter, one reads something that sounds almost like this: it has now happened. For there we read in 4:20 at the S, Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the border of Egypt. Realized eschatology, only of course it is not yet eschatology. It must have seemed to many that the promises of God to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had been amply fulfilled in the achievement of great David. And does not God now dwell enthroned above the cherubim in the temple on Mount Zion, established itself by David and by Solomon? Now, in any event, a theology grew up about David. It became official. It was recited in the official cult of the Jerusalem temple. And this was, as you know, the theology of God's eternal covenant with David. The gist of it is that Yahweh has chosen Zion as the seat of his earthly rule, there to live enthroned among his people forevermore. And he has promised to David a dynasty that will never end. Oh yes, a king could, if he sins, bring chastisement upon himself and his people, but the dynasty is eternal. God will never take his hesed, his gracious favor, from David. On the contrary, he will give the dynasty victory over all its foes and a wide domain with the kings of the earth fawning at its feet. This is first expressed in the Bible as we read it in the oracle of Nathan to David in 2 Samuel 7, which I cannot read all of it. David wants to build a house for Yahweh, and Nathan comes and says, in the name of Yahweh, no, you've got it wrong. I'm going to build you a house. Your son will succeed you. He will build the house. And then he goes on, I will be his father. He will be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men, but I will not take my gracious favor, my hesed, from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. Your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. That's a promise, unconditional. Now, this theology established itself early in Judah, I should say at least by the time of Solomon, and became in the course of the years nothing less than the national dogma. Note, by the way, how North Israel would change dynasties practically every generation, and how Judah, through all its history, never even made a motion toward changing dynasties. They might assassinate a worthless Davidite, but they would immediately put his little boy son on the throne. No one shall rule here or could thinkably rule here with legitimacy save David. Now, we see this theology expressed in the Psalms, especially in the royal Psalms. And since we know that these Psalms were actually used in the worship of the Jerusalem temple, we are having a window into the faith of the worshiping community of monarchical Judah. Now, of course, we cannot read all of these Psalms, but perhaps the clearest expression of it is the 89th Psalm, which is almost, you might say, a poetic text to the Nathan Oracle. It's a long psalm. We cannot read it all. A few verses will have to do. The promise comes to the Davidic king, 27. I will make him the firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. My hesed, my gracious favor, I will keep for him forever. My covenant will stand firm for him. I will establish his line forever, his throne like the days of heaven. If his children forsake my law, do not walk according to my ordinances, and so on, then I will punish their transgressions with the rod and their iniquity with scourges. But I will not remove from him my gracious favor or be false to my faithfulness. I do not violate my covenant or change the word that passed from my lips. Once for all, I've sworn by my holiness, I do not lie to David. His line shall endure forever, his throne like the sun before me, like the moon established forever, firm while the skies endure. Take those words seriously. This was the faith of the worshiping community in the immutable promises of God. And you need very little imagination to see why a theological as well as a political crisis took place when the eternal dynasty was not eternal and the eternal temple lay in ruins. Could God be unfaithful and untrue? Now, we cannot follow this through, but suppose you read at your leisure such psalms as 132, as 72, where we see the kingly ideal of justice expressed, as well as a number of others that you might well pay attention to that we cannot stop upon, and also the hymns of Zion and many others. Now, it'll be evident from this that the Davidic covenant has some similarity to the patriarchal covenant. There are differences, for the note of obligation is strongly present here. The king was obligated to do justice and was threatened with chastisement if he didn't. Nor was there any specification short of the end of the dynasty as to how severe that chastisement might be. Moreover, the king's obligation was conceived of in terms of the demands of covenant law. Nevertheless, the stress falls on the promises, and these are unqualified and unconditional. The dynasty will continue. This nation is secure because God has promised it. He may discipline king and people. He may discipline them severely, but he will never forsake his covenant word to David. And in this God, in these promises, the king has but to trust. As a matter of fact, there is evidence, into again which we cannot go, that the Davidic covenant was seen by many as a renewal and an extension of the covenant made with the patriarchs. There are notes in the Psalms that lead you to suppose so, where Psalm 18:30, where God is the shield of the people. And you remember Abraham addresses his God is his shield and his exceeding great reward. Or where we read, especially in Psalm 72, the promise to Abraham is transferred to the king as a wish for him. May men bless themselves by him. May all nations call him blessed. Almost the words of the promise to Abraham are transferred as a wish for the king. One gets the feeling, though one can't prove it, that these psalms are trying to say the promises of God to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob fulfilled in the Exodus and the conquest and now amply fulfilled by great David are now projected through great David to all the future indefinitely. Now such a theology must have given the nation an enormous sense of security. It's not a specific hope for the future. It is a cultic affirmation of immutable reality. The existing order of this nation is willed by God, founded by God, secure forever in his eternal promises. But that's a dangerous optimism. It could have led to disillusionment, and it missed it by very little. We may suppose, as the promises to David were affirmed in the cult, that the Sinaitic covenant with its stringent stipulations tended to get shoved aside. Now, we mustn't generalize. The Sinaitic and Exodus traditions were never forgotten. Moreover, never forget, there were parts of Israel that never bought this Davidic theology at all. Up north, it was anathema. And Jeroboam of the north had to found a new cult where such things would not be affirmed. We don't know much about that cult, but we may suppose that insofar as it was not paganized, its ritual centered precisely around the traditions of the Exodus and the Sinaitic covenant in the tribal league. These traditions were very much alive in North Israel, as, for example, the Elijah stories witness. And we know also from these prophetic narratives that the tradition of the old holy war is also very much alive. Nevertheless, one suspects that in North Israel too, the stress tended to lie on the eternal promises of God to the fathers of land, seed, and blessing. The traditions of Exodus and Sinai were cultically recited and feasts of covenant renewal were held, but if we may judge from Amos and Hosea, the whole business had been externalized. The feeling seems to have been that the stringent demands of the covenant could be satisfied by cultic observance alone. So that the very theology of covenant, which ought to have been a threat to the nation, became the earnest of its security. God is our God, we are his people. And as for the future, God will surely come to our aid with his mighty acts, as he did in the past. Now, such an optimistic view could not survive reality. It collided head on with the facts. The events of the 9th and 8th century must have placed it under strain, as the rising menace of Assyria threatened both nations with destruction and did destroy the north. In other words, the time came in Judah too, where present reality and the ideal affirmed in the cult were poles apart. And under such circumstances, men could not be satisfied with the continuation of the present state of affairs. They must hope for a better future which would amount to the radical improvement, nay, the reversal of the existing situation. There seems to have grown up, though we cannot document it, a longing for the lost glories of the idealized past, a yearning for a divine intervention that would recapture them and excel them. And to express this yearning, men reached back to those factors in the nation's history and tradition in which their confidence had originally rested. Now in Judah, naturally, this was a longing for the lost glories of David. Many, it would seem, looked for the time when God would intervene to reestablish the Davidic dynasty in all of its glory. We see an example of this in a little passage at the end of the book of Amos, which I cannot otherwise discuss, 9:11. In that day I will raise up, let me translate a little differently, the tumble-down shack of David, repair its breaches, raise its ruins, rebuild it as in the ancient days, that they may possess the remnant of the nations and all the nations who rightly belong to me, says Yahweh, who will do this. Ah, the time is coming when the golden age will return, the golden age of David. And it was probable, although again we cannot pause upon it, that it is in this context that there began the hope for the great day of Yahweh. The origin is disputed, but Von Rad is almost surely right in seeing it as resting in the recollection of the great holy wars of the tribal league, the days when Yahweh would come and inspirit his judges to deal with Israel's foes, like the great day of Midian mentioned in Isaiah. And it was a yearning for God to come again to the aid of his people, strike terror into their foes, and put things back right again. Now, this is not yet eschatology. The day of Yahweh was not the day, it was a day like the great days of the past. The popular hope did not expect a termination of God's purpose in history, but a turning of things for the better, a putting things back as they are occultically affirmed to be. Now the prophets brought a change in that their word was first of all a word of judgment, not of promise. They were rooted in these sacral traditions more than their hearers were, but they rejected the popular hope drawn from these traditions. Indeed, they made these very sacred traditions the basis and the norm of their evaluation of the national character. They saw the nation as under judgment of God for its sin, and when they attempted to describe this coming judgment, they frequently did so in terms of the very sacred traditions and saving events of the past which the people had made the basis of their hope. But of course, the prophets did not see the judgment as the end. All of them had hope for the future, even though Amos has little to say of it. But this hope did not, you see, lie in a straight line continuity with the present as the people expected. It lay beyond the judgment, through a new decisive divine event, through an act that would reestablish the relationship of God and people in a profounder way. And to describe this new event, new divine act, they again reached back to those very factors in the nation's tradition and history that had been the foundation of its existence and self-understanding, and projected them upon the future as the pattern for God's final provision for his people. And here we see the beginning of what we may call eschatology. For this new divine intervention, though described in terms of patterns drawn from the past, is not a repetition of a past, not a mere reestablishing things as they used to be. It is a new act that will exceed the past, that will make actual the true intention of the past in a deeper way, and it is final. Nothing was looked for beyond it. It would be forever. It would never end. Now, in view of what we have said, it is therefore not surprising that the eschatology of the 8th century prophets did not follow one single pattern, but more than one. And at the risk of oversimplification, and it is a risk, we can say that two stand out, corresponding to the two views of election and covenant already observed. On the one hand, there were those who reached back to the traditions of Exodus and Sinai and who conceived of the future in terms of the coming down of the covenant curses, which would later be followed by a restoration of the covenant bond, the covenant on the pattern of the Sinaitic covenant. And on the other hand, there was a reaching back to the traditions of Zion and Royal David, which conceived the future in terms of a severe chastisement followed by God's vindication of his kingly rule in Zion under an ideal scion of the house of David. Now the first of these, though we cannot go into exegetical subjects here in the little time that is left, the first of these finds its classic expression, as you certainly know, in North Israel's great prophet Hosea. I think you find the same patterns in Amos, but we have not time to go into it, and in any event, Amos does not say much about what hope he has for the future. His hope is rather implicit than explicit. But with Hosea, the case is clear. He was steeped in the traditions of the Sinaitic covenant through and through. The Davidic covenant didn't mean a thing to him. He never mentions it. Indeed, he's negative toward the monarchy as such, or rather neutral, I should say. Hosea's attack, as you know, fell upon the apostasy which was taking place in Israel, specifically the practice of the fertility cult, which he said more than once had rotted the national character through and through. See classically chapter 4, beginning, say, at verse 11, where we hear him, "Wine and new wine take away the understanding. My people inquire of a thing of wood. Their staff gives them oracles. A spirit of whoredom has led them astray. They sacrifice on the tops of the mountains and make offerings under the hills, the Baal cult." And he goes on to say that he won't punish their daughters for committing adultery, for they've taught them to do that way. The character of the land, the moral character, and the religious character is corroded out. And again, Hosea indicts this apostasy, and you will note how often he does it against the backdrop of the gracious deeds of Yahweh in the Exodus days. For example, 9:10, "Like grapes in the wilderness I found Israel, like first fruits on the fig tree. I saw your fathers, but they came to Baal Peor and consecrated themselves to Baal." 11:1, "When Israel was a child, then I loved him, and from Egypt I called my son. The more I called them, the more they went from me and kept sacrificing to the Baalim," and so on. Or 13:4, "I am Yahweh your God from the land of Egypt. You know no God but me. Besides me there is no Savior. It was I who knew you in the desert, in the land of drought. But when they had fed to the full, they were filled and their heart was lifted up and they forgot me." Always the sin is rendered more heinous against the backdrop of the prevenient grace, which was the bond, the basis of Israel's obligation to Yahweh. Hosea, as we know, introduced the figure of marriage to describe the covenant bond. It may have had its background in the sacred marriage of the fertility cult, but it apparently had its parallels in Hosea's own life, for it appears that his wife was an adulteress. "But just so," he says, "Yahweh has married Israel in the covenant bond, and as her Lord, he expects of her faithfulness and obedience. But Israel, in running after other gods, has committed adultery, has committed whoredom. She has violated the cardinal stipulations of the covenant, the marriage covenant, and faces divorce, being driven from a land." Hosea does not say she has broken covenant very clearly, but he says it as clearly as you would wish. He had three sons, children, all of them with symbolical names. And what was the last one? "Call his name Lo-Ammi, not my people, for I am not your people, I am not your God, and you are not my people." Now that last, "I will be your God, you will be my people," is the formula of covenant, and Hosea turned it right around. It is not so. The covenant is over. Israel will be hurled from a land, sent into exile. He calls down the covenant curses upon Israel, and Hosea, when he tries to describe this exile, does it in terms of a new wilderness wandering, and at times one thinks almost in terms of a new Egyptian bondage. It is the repetition of the past. "Now he will remember their iniquity and punish their sins. They shall return to Egypt." 8:13. Hosea, of course, had a hope beyond the judgment, and it rested in the mercy, the undeserved and unspeakable mercy of God. But this hope he described again in terms of the covenant. Though the word isn't used, here is the beginning of the expectation of a new covenant. "For God
will reach out and bring Israel back from this wilderness of exile and give her a new entry into the land, speak home to her heart, and restore the covenant bond. I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you to me in righteousness, in justice, and gracious favor, and in mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know Yahweh. So we see that Hosea looks out beyond the broken covenant and the imposition of the covenant curses to a restoration of the covenant, a new covenant, though he does not use that word. Now finally, and we must hurry to the end of this part of our lecture, you would of course expect that the other pattern mentioned above finds its classic expression, and you don't have to get guess who, the great Isaiah of Jerusalem. Now, Isaiah was rooted and grounded in the theology of Zion and David, and it's the basis of his criticism of the national policy. You can't make sense out of Isaiah if you don't realize this. At first glance, Isaiah's political advice seems so inconsistent, if not contradictory, that you're inclined to put the man down as either a weathercock or a schizophrenic. How could so many opinions be under one skin? In his early youth, resisting bitterly the surrendering of the nation's independence to Assyria. In his middle life, and later on in his life, on many occasions, opposing rebellion against Assyria. And finally, when the chips all went down and Sennacherib had the city in the vice, he promised that, he told Hezekiah, stand firm, don't worry, God won't let him come here. I will defend this city and save it for my servant David's sake and for my own sake. Isaiah was rooted and grounded in this, and he criticized his kings largely because they would not trust in the promises of Yahweh to David, but instead trusted in treaties, alliances, and in borrowed armaments. Isaiah was informed by this theology. We could lecture on it for many hours, but we cannot do it here. In returning and rest, you will be saved. In quietness and trust is your strength. Yahweh has founded Zion, and in it his faith-afflicted people find refuge. And again he speaks this way. Now, this is not to say that Isaiah was ignorant of the Sinaitic covenant. That's been said, but it isn't true. Nor is it true that he held the Davidic covenant in the usual way. Now, it's quite true that Isaiah's book contains only two explicit references to the Exodus events, and these in very difficult passages. But his tack on the sins of society clearly understood that Israel's relationship to God rested in his prevenient grace. This again could be documented from his book, had we the time. I think especially of that matchlessly beautiful Song of the Vineyard in the fifth chapter. The vineyard master had a fine vineyard. He tilled it as well as a man could till it, and he put sorig vines in there, the very best kind they were. And what did he expect? A good grape crop. And what did he get? Rotten grapes. So what will he do to this vineyard? He'll knock the wall down and let the cattle eat it. That's what he'll do. So you see again, Israel, who as the vineyard has received God's grace, must respond to that. And you see this note. Isaiah is not ignorant. He did not believe in absolutely unconditional promises. In fact, I think we can say that in Isaiah, the two patterns are in balance and are harmonized by the stress on the possibility of chastisement inherent in the Davidic. We cannot go into this in detail. It is at least interesting that in a couple of passages, see 28:21 and 29:1-4, when Isaiah wished to describe God's intervention to judge Israel, he reached back exactly to traditions of great David. I turned it around. God will besiege Jerusalem like David once did. He will be on the other side. Yet I can see no evidence that Isaiah looked for the total destruction of his country or the end of the Davidic dynasty. To him, Assyria was the instrument of God's judgment, but only an instrument that will in its turn be judged. In fact, God whistles Assyria to come in and do his work as I might whistle to a dog. But he will in one time put a hook in Assyria's nose as one would put a hook in the nose of an ox and wheel her around and send her back home when he's through with her. He will not be allowed her to take Zion. Therefore, the judgment to him is a chastisement. A terrible chastisement, but a chastisement. It is a purge, a refining process, which will bring forth a purified nation, a remnant. Sha'ar Yashub, a remnant, will return. So it's scarcely surprising that we should see in Isaiah the beginnings of what we call the messianic hope, the hope of a coming king of the line of David, under whom God's purposes beyond the judgment will be brought to their fruition. Chapter 9, chapter 11 especially. Now, in closing, this was not a ditto of the popular hope, not at all affirmed in the cult. You see, it was not a hope for this nation now as it is. It did not lie in a straight line continuity with the existing order, a hope that every king was expected to realize. It lay beyond an awful judgment. The chastisement allowed for by the official theology is not a theoretical possibility in Isaiah. It is affirmed as an inevitable thing that is coming. His hope is for a purified nation, and it is not a mere repetition of the kingly ideal. It is a description of a coming king, unlike any actual king who would fulfill this ideal and make the promises actual. Now, tomorrow I want us to carry on back to our original question and I think see the bases theologically for the tragedy of Jeremiah. I thank you very much.
Enable us, O God, to remember what we have heard in this hour as we continue to inquire in the fellowship of thy people. Be with us in our going forth and in our coming in, and as the light of eternity falls upon our passing days, may thy truth and mercy illuminate each step of the way.